Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Hello, everybody. Alex Nicely here with Dr. Jake Mann of Birmingham. Dr. Mann has chosen for today's discussion two heavy-hitting publications. The first is from Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition, first author Cohen, and it addresses the value of intestinal rehabilitation treatment in congenital diarrhea. In that article, Toronto, Cincinnati, and Haifa joined forces to assemble cohorts of children whose longer-term courses they report. It's now well accepted, I believe, that to take care of bowel failure patients at the hands of a specialized team produces better results. The problem is, most bowel failure that's been studied is short bowel syndrome. And unfortunately, that's not what we're confronted with in children with congenital diarrhea. 15 of those kids in all did worse overall than did the control short bowel syndrome patients with whom they were compared, beg pardon. And they had lower survival rates, 39% versus 80% at 10 years. However, they fared better than did historical congenital diarrhea controls, and in some respects, they did as well as short bowel syndrome patients. Jake, tell us why you picked this particular article.
Thanks, Alex. This paper seems really interesting to me. I've always been someone who's generally drawn towards rare diseases and these congenital diarrheas and enteropathies, or CODE as the abbreviations used here, are, in my view, an interesting group of conditions. They may well be multisystemic disorders, not completely isolated to the bowel, and also got some personal experience in them, as we have a bit of a cohort of phenotypic diarrhea, also known as trichohepatic enteric syndrome, or TTC37 mutation associated intestinal failure in Birmingham. And this is also a paper coming out from the GIFT group, the Group for Improvement of Intestinal Function and Treatment in Toronto Sick Kids, which is one of the world's leading intestinal rehabilitation groups. So, you know, that together, this should be a relative authority on the topic and the current state of play. So I think some interesting points to pull out is that, firstly, simply to acknowledge just how rare these conditions are, given that this is a relatively large cohort and major referral centres. And over the space of 14 years, they had 15 patients. And for many of the diagnoses, they only had a single patient. And as the authors do acknowledge, this may influence their data, because when you only have 15 patients, you only need one transplant or one death from an unusual cause to actually then have a substantial impact on the overall incidence of these event rates. And kind of following on from that, I would just reflect on the choice of title. The authors had opted to focus on their positive outcomes in the sense that matched to short bowel patients who'd had an equivalent degree of PN and age, a similar age, this group of CODE patients had similar rates of growth and central line bacterial infections and nephrocalcinosis. I'd say my main takeaway is actually that overall these patients had worse outcomes with higher mortality and longer time on PN and more likely to need transplantation.
That's how I read it as well, that they were putting a very brave face on unpromising results. However, there were a few kids who seemed to straighten up and fly right if they just got old enough. Would you like to comment on that?
Yes, that is certainly a well-described as it can be in ultra-rare disorders, a feature of some of these conditions. such as phenotypic diarrhea, that they do get a little bit better when you get to teenage years, as long as you can get them through. The other thing that certainly has come out in other data, not necessarily shown in this paper, is that these patients with congenital diarrheas or congenital, same for kind of pseudo-obstruction neuromuscular type indications for long-term PN, haven't had the same inflammatory hit that patients with necrotizing enterocolitis or very abnormal gastroschisis with multiple infections have had. And that probably has some beneficial effect on their liver, meaning that they're a little bit less likely to get the intestinal failure associated liver disease.
All right. What else can people take away other than we'll never see one of these?
Well, they may not necessarily see a cohort of these, but there is an ever-increasing number of patients on home PN, and these are patients who are highly likely to require essentially lifelong PN, apart from a few exceptions. And I think that one take-home message would be that actually, if the patients can be stable on PN, then the outcomes are pretty good. There's no reason why they should necessarily have impairment in growth or recurrent line thromboses or infections. So the argument that the authors make is that centralization of care in centers of expertise is of benefit, and I think that that's consistent with most evidence in almost all other specialties as well.
Tell us, what is the status of intestinal failure care in children in the United Kingdom? With the NHS, you have an opportunity to centralize such care. Has this been done?
Yes, so there is centralization at almost all levels. So there are major gastroenterology centres around the UK, and they tend to take the lead on home parenteral nutrition for a region. I guess the downside you could say is that then some patients live comparatively far away from their nearest hospital that offers home PN. But the plus side is that then there are areas of expertise, and that the centres get reasonable experience in caseloads that include at least a few of these ultra-rare disorders.
Would you advocate taking the ultra-rare disorders and sending them all to Birmingham?
As interesting as that would be from a research perspective, I think that you have to have a very strong argument to doing something like that where there is a highly specific treatment. And currently the management for these patients really focuses on if they can have intestinal rehabilitation and achieve enteral autonomy, then that's obviously the best outcome. Home PN or small bowel transplantation. And those can be facilitated in a number of different centres. There are very few conditions where, for example, there is only a single centre in the UK that manages it. And the example I'm aware of is lipodystrophy. And part of the reason for that is because leptin therapy is highly efficacious, but also extremely expensive. And therefore, you centralise it for that region. Small bowel transplant is centralised to only two centres as it currently stands. And I think that probably also helps with caseload and experience for those teams.
Thank you. Jake, you chose a rather different topic for the second paper to be discussed today. And it's not from JPGN, it's from J. Hepaton. And it has to do with the possibility of identifying good actor pediatric patients and distinguishing them very early on in their post-liver transplant course from bad actor liver transplant patients. By good actor, I mean the ones that will sit down and deal with their new liver, make friends with it, and go on without particular problems. That is a good thing to know, to be able to say, we think we can manage this particular patient in a particular way because she's going to be okay. Or according to her biomarker profile, she should be okay. And of course, there's always the possibility that if you find somebody whose biomarker profile is disadvantageous, you could say, maybe there's some way to tweak this patient's metabolism, tweak their immune system, in order to induce a more favorable profile. Have I got the gist of this paper from Hanover yet?
Absolutely. This is really moving into an era of personalized medicine in terms of immunosuppression post-transplant. And I think part of the reason I found this paper so interesting is that, firstly, it's very ambitious and incredible they've managed to complete it. They've got almost 250 patients with multiple sampling, pre-transplant, intense
a week
sampling.
Out, 2 weeks out, 3 weeks out, a fortnight, well, a month out, and then again at 3 and 6, and was it, I think that comes from it, and then at a year. And all of them, they managed a particular set of cytokines, and they measured a particular set of cytokines, and they looked at a particular set of lymphocytes using flow cytometry and clinical biochemistry techniques to do both.
Absolutely. And then the bit I liked is that they took an unbiased approach, initially looking from the cytokine profile, and then grouped patients based on what their cytokine profile was like over the first couple of weeks post-transplant, and then saw, well, in those groups, what were their rates of rejection, and found in particular there was one group that had no rejection episodes at all, another group that only had one or two rejection episodes, and then that gave them a particular pattern of cytokines that essentially was predictive of, over the first year, minimal rejection. There were other clinical factors that were associated with this, such as it being a living-related transplantation. But nonetheless, you still have a cytokine profile, essentially a measurable biomarker. The clinical implication of this is that then, if you are able to measure such a panel early on and find that your patient had the reverse findings, high levels of the pro-inflammatory, low levels of the anti-inflammatory cytokines, should you, in anticipation, increase their immunosuppression level?
Well, should you?
This data would seem to suggest that those patients who do not have this cytokine profile are more likely to have episodes of acute T-cell mediated rejection. And on that basis, it would make sense that if you're able to avoid those episodes, then you're probably more likely to have better graft function long term.
With that in mind, this is new information. This is published just this past month, in May. Now, what are you doing with your patients in light of this new information? Have you instituted new protocols in Birmingham?
Not yet. Birmingham is one center that continues to do protocol liver biopsies. So admittedly, we wouldn't have evidence this early on, but that does allow us some opportunity to reevaluate immunosuppression in patients who may have had a degree of inflammation that's been otherwise clinically undetected at a year post-transplant. I think that the main caveats to this in my mind is that two things. Firstly, the direction of causality is not clear. And you could argue that doesn't matter, but by which I mean the patients who had a certain cytokine profile in their blood, a essentially pro-inflammatory cytokine profile, are also the patients who have more episodes of rejection. Well, that seems relatively biologically plausible. You could say that's obvious, that they've got a higher cytokine profile because they're having episodes of rejection. Or is it that this is a true subclinical evidence of rejection? So that is not clear. The other thing is that there are relatively small numbers of patients in the group that they've based most of their their story around. This group that had no rejection only had 16 patients in it out of the total 250. Now, that is fine. That's how the data fell. But you probably would want to see similar results and or ideally a prospective study where there is actually adjustment of immunosuppression in response to cytokine levels and then demonstrating perhaps at a subsequent liver biopsy an improvement in histology or resolution of inflammation. That would be lovely data.
Why don't you, I know that you can't go back in time and gather lymphocytes for subset analysis, but you probably have samples of serum or plasma in Birmingham that could be exploited to confirm retrospectively the idea that patients with a particular pro-inflammatory phenotype were the ones that at 1, 2, 4, 5 years actually did have more inflammation and more fibrosis than did the ones who had no such pro-inflammatory phenotype. Is that a reasonable possibility?
That would be a great validation study. I think the key points to that would be careful patient selection and making sure that you had samples taken at a time that were analogous to this study, because it's very easy to end up collecting blood at the time when a patient comes in for their biopsy because their ALT is 400 and you think they've got acute rejection. But that doesn't really tell you any information, interesting information. I think most hepatologists would realize that there's something going on pretty wrong at that stage. The time we would want is a patient who has seems stable, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks post-transplant, good transaminases. You'd want a stored serum sample then in a patient who then subsequently over the next couple of months developed a substantial episode of T-cell mediated rejection, and you would want to see then if that broadly you can replicate these findings. And if it were possible simply to replicate this paper with samples out of the freezer, then that would be wonderful.
I bet that that's underway at the moment, if not in Birmingham, but some other ambitious institution. But I don't know why I don't expect Birmingham to have all those biopsy. If they're doing protocol biopsies, then surely they should be doing protocol phlebotomies as well. Or maybe protocol phlebotomies will be part of everybody's transplant management protocol, just in order to have samples like the ones you mentioned available for retrospective work.
True, there are always challenges in biobanking samples in every patient in such a systematic way, but I'll have a look in the freezer. The only other thing I'm going to just say about this paper, which is a bit of a personal gripe, is that they haven't freely shared the analysis code, which from a bioinformatic perspective makes me a little bit frustrated, because I feel that code is very, yes, it is scientific methods, but it is a key part of reproducibility. And I don't think that anyone can steal your data once you've shared code. The authors do say that upon reasonable request, they will share their code. I would just have loved it if they had it already there, permanent identifier that anyone could go and see exactly how they've run their analyses.
Jake, it's time to write a letter to the editor and to say, next time something like this comes along, make sure the code gets shared. Thank you very much. We seem to have run out of time because, in part, we have to let the listeners know that two programs are coming up which may be of interest to them. A hepatology get-together, the 5th Liver Transplant School, is to be held on September 25th of this year. And a few days before that, a gastroenterology conference is to be held on the 21st of September. Go to the ESPGHAN website in order to find details and think about attending. You might learn something. Jake, thank you very much again.
Thanks very much, Alex.